Welcome to Inspiring on BBS Radio. I am your host, Jeanette Bryan. Today's show is particularly special. We are going to interview two guests. Our first guest is a young girl who made a very commendable decision to stop using substances. She's 19 years old, and at her age, she made the decision that abusing drugs, alcohol, was not something that she wanted to partake any longer. She's here today to share her story with teens and other young adults and reach out to help them to take the same steps that she took that saved her. During the second part of our show, I will bring on a terrific woman who's eager to share her message with the world about the importance of organ donation to save lives. Susan Roth is on the mission. Her book titled The Reluctant Dawn will bring laughter and tears. She empowers in her determination about letting others know about polycystic kidney disease. It's very inspiring. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Inspiring. Please feel free to call us and share your viewpoints. Hello, Shauna.
Hi.
I am glad to have you here, and I'm glad that you are going to come share your story with me and my listeners today. Let me thank you in advance for your courage, what you are doing to help others, and young adult is very commendable, and I'm very proud of you. So, Shauna, tell me, how old were you when you started using substances?
I was 18 years old, attending Southern Vermont College. It was towards the end of my school year. I had really stopped losing interest in sports, losing interest in my normal lifestyle. I wasn't on campus. I wasn't associating myself with my same schoolmates. I was barely on campus. And people, when they saw me, they would always question, where have I been? What have I been up to? And I just told them, oh, I've been busy doing my own thing. When all actuality, I was hanging out with people from Bennington, using substances. It took over my life, took over my focus, took over my mindset. At the time, I didn't realize it. I just liked what I was doing because those people accepted me. They didn't judge me for it. They didn't look down at me. They welcomed me. So at the time, I thought what I was doing was okay. I didn't see anything wrong with it. And then
what led you to it?
Honestly, I didn't know at the time, but it was a way to numb my feelings, a way to take my mindset out of reality and be on cloud nine, you can say. And I just didn't want to face my feelings. I didn't want to face my issues. So I turned to a drug, which numbed all those feelings.
Why didn't you turn out to something else? Why are drugs? Like, who was the person who introduced you to those substances? Why drugs? And what kind of drugs were they? What kind of substances was it? Was it alcohol? Was it drugs? What kind of drugs was it?
And I was
how many?
I was using cocaine. I was using Percocets. I was using Xanax bars. I was smoking marijuana. Anything that someone put in front of me, to believe it or not, I would do. It was a way for me to feel accepted. It was a way for me to be like everyone else. I didn't turn to anything else because I didn't feel like I had that person to turn to talk to my feelings. Like drugs were always available to me. They were, instead of having that one person to go and talk to about my feelings, they were always a concrete shoulder to lean on, you can say. And so for
what about your parents?
My parents?
What about your, yes.
My
what about talking
when
to them?
I was four. My mother was 3 hours north in Vermont, and we have more of a friendship relationship at times. So for me, I didn't really want to disappoint her by telling her what I was doing. And with her being 3 hours away, it was only over the phone. And for me, that just wasn't enough. Helped for me. So
you wanted
people.
You wanted a friend, constant friend next to you because of that hole of not having somebody there for you and the void. You just turned to drugs.
Yes.
So how was your attitude then towards life? How was your attitude towards life when you decided that using was the only thing that made sense to you?
My attitude towards life became about partying, all about associating myself with those people. I didn't want to be involved in school. I didn't want to do homework. I didn't want to wake up early for class. I didn't want to see anyone on campus. I lost interest in everything. I just lost my whole demeanor on life. I hit rock bottom.
Wow. And what? Yeah. How did you realize that you needed to stop that? You know, it is time. I have to. I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I want to get out of this. When did you realize that?
When I was at the police station the night I got busted, it was because the police, they don't sugarcoat anything. They put the hardcore facts in your place, like right in your face. They told me, because I was on a full ride, I can make one phone call and your full ride scholarship to your school can be taken away. You can be charges posed against you, and since I'm over 18, they would stick on my record for life, which will then affect my future careers. They told me that just everything that I had going for me could be taken away with the snap of their fingers, and I could potentially kill myself with what I was doing by overdosing. I could get in car accidents because I was driving under the influences of these drugs. It's just there was nothing in that lifestyle that was going positively for me. And the fact that I got busted opened my eyes. It was what I needed to see that what I was doing was wrong, that it was affecting me physically, it was affecting me mentally, it was affecting my relationships with people. The people I should have had relationships with were ending. So it was just the blunt of being busted by the police is what I needed to open my eyes. And every day I thank the Lord that I got busted by the cops, because it was what I needed to see that what I was doing was wrong.
Now, Shona, let me ask you, that day when you got busted, what are the events that led you being busted by the police? And how did you approach the topic with your parents and your mom to tell her what was happening? What was her reaction?
Well, what had happened was my boyfriend at the time was a renowned cocaine dealer for that town. And so We were going to pick up more product to sell. And we didn't know at the time, but the police had already had suspicion about the house of where his bigger dealer was. So they were watching The house. They watched us left. Right when we left, they pulled us over under a traffic condition, saying we didn't use a signal. After I got busted and everything was all said and done, the first person I called to talk to about it was actually my godmother, who I look up to as a mother. I told her I had no idea what to do because I was too embarrassed to tell my mom. I didn't want to face the disappointment. Couple of days went by, and I talked to my godmother more, and she's like, you really need to let your mom know before she finds out someone else, whether it's an online source, because it's a small town where my mom comes from in Vermont. Mm-hmm. So I called her and told her. She was irate, disappointed, angry. Every bad emotion would come to her, like any other mother would, because you don't want to see your child doing things like this. And so she was talking to me, and she gave me an ultimatum. She told me, you can either move back home with me, or you can move to Massachusetts with your mother, a godmother, but you're not staying in that town because there's nothing there for you except trouble. I at first didn't want to go because I had made what I thought were friendships, and I didn't want to leave it, but I knew I had to. It was the only way things were going to change. I'm not in contact with any of those people anymore, so what I thought were my true friends clearly weren't. And I've started a better life for me here, and it's what I needed to change my life.
Now, how did you cut ties with the people that you thought were your friends?
Moving from the state. They all said that because I was planning on going home to Vermont throughout the summer at some point, And they were planning on keeping in contact with me through Facebook, through texting, through calls. I haven't heard from a single one of those people in that town since I moved. So it was going to be an online/texting friendship until I came back for school the next year, but I didn't return for school, and none of them stayed in contact with me.
What about your scholarship? Do you still have your scholarship, or did you lose it?
I didn't necessarily lose it because of getting caught up in this. My grades were bad at the end of the year, to the point of where you have to keep them over a certain grade level to keep yourself, maintain the scholarship. And since my GPA dropped lower than that, I ended up losing it because of bad grades. So it wasn't necessarily because of getting caught up, but using drugs took my focus away from school, which resulted in the bad grades. So I didn't get caught, didn't lose my scholarship, but because of my grades dropped so low, that's the reason I lost my scholarship.
So the first step, as I was listening to you, the first step that you took was to reach out to your godmother, and then the next step you took was to talk to your mom. When you spoke to all those two people, and then you moved from the town that you were in, and the people that were surrounding you that were doing drugs and alcohol, what were the rest of the steps that you took to make your life better, to feel good about yourself, and to understand that turning into and using substances was not the answer to your problems? What were the steps that you took?
The steps I took was completely eliminating myself from the temptations, the people that, those types of people. Even it's hard if you feel like for me, they were my life. They were the people I was always around, but I eliminated mm-hmm. myself from them. Eliminating myself and moving to a town where I didn't know anyone gave me a lot of time for reflection. While looking for a job when I moved here, I looked back at what had happened. I looked back at those types of people, and time moved on. And it was just honestly a lot of reflection and a lot of growing, personal growth, because mm-hmm. you have to be able to look at yourself and admit when you do something wrong, even if it means swallowing your pride. Because I was the type of person where I always wanted, strove to perfection, and when I hit rock bottom, it took me to look at myself, take a hard look at myself, and just say, wow, what I was doing was wrong. What I was doing wasn't okay. It wasn't just affecting me. It was affecting everyone around me. So first is admitting what you were doing is wrong, whether you want to or not. And then you have to go within that and see the reasons of who it was affecting, and not just be selfish and think about you. And you have to see the impact and what could have happened and where it could have led if you stayed on that track. So it's a lot of reflection, and you have to be able to voice your emotions to people. You can't keep everything bottled up, whether it's a mother, a best friend, a boyfriend. You have to have people that you can surround yourself with, that you can talk to, because without that, you won't make it. You'll hit rock bottom like I did. You'll turn to substances to numb those feelings. And if you don't feel comfortable talking to any of those people, there's always counselors and psychiatrists and all those people. Just to vent. As long as you get it out, it helps, because you hear, you have other people's feedback. It's not just you thinking about the situation. So the more people you're comfortable with and have a close circle, the better it is to get through situations like these. Because if I was on my own, I probably would have regressed and got back into that lifestyle.
Now, let me tell you, let me ask you something. As you mentioned all the steps that you took, and not once did you say that you met with someone. Did you meet with any counselor? Did you talk to someone outside of your family? Or your family was your only support in getting you to stop using?
I didn't feel like I needed to see a counselor because I had my godmother, I had my mother, I had my sisters. So for me, having those people were enough for me to get through it and handle it. Some people might need more, some people might need less, but for me, I felt comfortable with just those people that I didn't need to go see a counselor, and I didn't need to go see a psychiatrist or anything like that.
So basically, you went cold turkey, and you came from using, abusing, and then stopping altogether with the help of your family. So family support basically help you come out of the verge of losing yourself, losing your life, and throw away the future that your mom had built for you.
Yes, and believe it or not, it's the hardest thing to admit to your family, because you don't want to disappoint them, that what you're doing when you're doing something as bad as I was. But in the end of the day, once I get past the anger and the disappointment, they're always going to love you, and they're always going to support you. And as long as you learn from your mistakes, they're always going to be there for you like they still are for me today. So as long as you put out the effort to show that you know what you did was wrong and you want to change who you are, your family is always going to be there for you. It might not be the next day, but they're always going to like start to come back and realize, like, wow, she really is changing. And for me, they gave them the time. I talked to them. I personally feel like I wasn't, like, physically addicted to the drugs, because when I moved to Massachusetts, I didn't have the withdrawal signs. My godmother herself even said I didn't show signs of withdrawal. But for me, I had the support to be able to talk to people about it. So it's not like I was just going through it by myself and sitting there thinking about what I could be doing if I was still there and all that. I kept myself busy. I had people to talk to. So I really just worked on growing back into the person I wanted to be.
Now that you move in Massachusetts, how is your relationship with your mom now that you are doing better with yourself, you're going to school, you're working, and so forth? What is what is your relationship now with your mom, and had your relationship with your godmother threatened?
Honestly, because it's been so long since it happened, and I have not used since I've gotten busted, it's perfectly fine. I'm able to talk to them. They know what I've gone through. Like, I feel like I could hit rock bottom again, but I'm not going to let myself hit rock bottom. And for my relationships with them, they're fine. I always know I can talk to them. I know that they're always going to be there for me. So our relationships are fine and mended.
And how long has it been that you haven't been around drugs, any substances, and so far? How long has it been?
I would say it's been since I got busted in May 22nd, 2012. Great. That night just opened my eyes up to the point of, I don't need this in my life. I don't need these people in my life. And you just got to put your foot down and keep your mentality to it, and your mind can overcome anything. It's a very powerful tool.
That's wonderful. And what about the friendship that you're building now in Massachusetts? Since you left Vermont, what are the friendships that you are building? Are the friendships that you think that can drag you down, or are the friendships that are solid enough to keep you to your focus and to what you have set yourself to become in the future?
I think I've chosen my friends a lot wiser now that I'm here. I don't associate myself with anyone who are using substances because I don't want to be around it. And I know how it can affect you, whether you're in denial or whether you know how it affects you. My friends that I associate with are straight edge and clean, and that's how I want to keep it, because I'm trying to develop myself into a career, and I don't want to be around any of those types of people to hold me back.
Now, let me ask you, what kind of advice will you provide to teens and young adults that are going through the same thing that you went through, or even thinking about starting going through the path that once in your time in your life you took? What kind of advice do you provide to them?
One of the major things that I can tell them is that if they are in it and they want to get out, you always can. Don't ever feel like you're stuck in that lifestyle, no matter how far into using you are. Even like if you don't have the opportunity to move away from this where you are, like I did, you can always start with your family. You just have to start eliminating those types of people, whether you want to or not, because if they're your true friends, they won't put those drugs in front of you and say, here, have some. True friends should have your back, whether it's telling you what's right and wrong. They should know the difference, and if they don't know the difference themselves, they're not your true friends. And another advice that you can say is you have to be able to swallow your pride. No one's perfect. Everyone makes mistakes. And once you get past the part of swallowing your pride, you can get help, whether you need to go to rehab, whether you need to see a counselor, whether you just need to get in touch with your family, whether you need to make a new circle of friends. You always have that opportunity. There's so many people in this world, don't feel like you're stuck in a situation, because you can always get out. And the more you let it spiral down into worse, the harder it's going to be to dig yourself out of the hole. So the quicker you start, and even just don't even starting drugs, is the best way to go, whether all your friends are doing it and they call you a loser and they pick on you. Good, they're not your true friend. Let them pick on you. Let them say all those things. You don't want to ever start, because it spirals down quicker than you think, and you'll be over your head before you know it, like I was.
Now, what did you learn about that whole experience? What are the things that you come out learning from the experience that you went through?
I've grown that drugs do not help you face your issues. It's like Novocaine. They numb the pain of those feelings while you're under the drug, but you're always going to come down from the high, whether you want to or not. No matter how often you use it, you're always going to have time where you need to face your feelings, and it's going to hurt you. So you need to like deal with your problems rather than suppressing them and bottling them up. And drugs will never help you blossom into an adult. They will hold you back. They're not going to let you grow. They're not going to face who you need to become. You need to learn from problems, not hide them.
Good for you. I'm very, very proud of you. And I'm hoping that my listeners are getting some information from your story. And I'm very proud of you. And I'm sure your mother is very proud of you to see that you are back on track and doing the things that you should do to have a better life for yourself. Thank you so much for sharing that story. And we will take a short break. And when we come back, Susan Roth will share her insight about PKD and organ donation. Susan Roth is a living kidney donor, but she's more than that. She's a storyteller. She says it's because she's Irish. The author of the inspiring, poignant, funny, and powerful award-winning book, The Reluctant Donor, Susan is also a freelance writer for The Shattered Observer and has been published in The Chicken Soup for the Soul books, Grieving and Recovering, and also The Chicken Soup for the Soul, Harvard Medical School series. Say hello to the better, to a better body. Susan serves on the executive committee of the Living Donor Council of the National Kidney Foundation and volunteers with the PKD Foundation. She works tirelessly to tell others how organ donation has saved her family. There have been 6 kidney transplants to 6 different people in her family because of a genetic disease. Susan was the only one in her family not to inherit the disease. She was named after her grandmother, who died of kidney failure before Susan was born. Sadly, that grandmother died in 1940s while a doctor in the Netherlands was experimenting with the concept of dialysis. Today, Susan has made a difference for many people beside her family, 19 of which have been afflicted with PKD. She is one of the nation's greatest advocates for organ transplant, and she is a sought-after speaker across the country. Stay tuned. We will be right back. So much. Now, we were talking with Shauna earlier before we took our short break, and we are going to thank Shauna for coming in today and sharing her story with our listeners. So thank you again, Shauna, for tuning in and coming in and sharing your story with your listeners. I have Susan Ruff with me here now. Susan, welcome, and thank you so much for joining me in Inspiring Talk Show. Before we start and before I start asking you any questions whatsoever, let me just give you a few facts about PKD. It is the most common genetic disease, more common than Down syndrome, cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy, sickle cell anemia, hemophilia, and Huntington's disease combined. Afflicts 650,000 Americans suffer from it. 12.5 million people worldwide have PKD. Of the more than 116,000 people waiting for an organ transplant, over 90,000 are waiting for a kidney transplant. If one of your parents has PKD, you have 50% chance of inheriting the disease. PKD equally affects men, women, and children. Age, race, or ethnic origin does not matter. It does not skip a generation. Suzanne, welcome. Let me just jump right into it by asking you my first burning question. What is PKD and how prevalent is it?
Well, what is the disease?
Yes.
The disease is poly, means many, so many cysts form and eventually choke the disease or the kidneys and cause them to fail. It's a hereditary disease, as you mentioned, and in my family, I was the only one that did not inherit it.
The title is The Reluctant Donor. Why were you reluctant?
Well, because I was terrified. I went into being a donor kicking and screaming all the way. I was afraid of hospitals and needles and The sight of blood has been known to cause me to faint. I don't think anybody likes hospitals, but we've had eight people in our family die of PKD, including our mother, so I associated hospitals with death. And I was the last person you think who would willingly have a body part removed, and yet I knew what my sister's life would be like because of the life my mother led. She had the same disease.
So I understand you are the only one in your immediate family who didn't inherit the disease. How does that make you feel?
I guess a little bit guilty and yet happy, but also you feel a little bit guilty because you are happy that you did not inherit it, and yet I think it gave me a great deal of a responsibility to tell our family story, and I think I realized that I was destined to be the one to give my sister a kidney. She faced a 5 to 6 year wait at the time. I think it's now about a 6 to 8 year wait if you need a kidney transplant, because so many people are on the waiting list, as you mentioned.
How is your sister doing now?
She is fabulous. She's healthy again and happy, and it's funny, I was not getting along with her very well before she became sick, and I think it was a very good life lesson for me, because I realized that she was, I thought she had become grumpy and not very much fun and didn't like her very much anymore. And sisters are like that.
I don't think we like our brothers or sisters very much sometimes, so that's okay, that's fine.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. It's just human nature within families to squabble sometimes and to not get along, and that's where I was with my sister. And when she collapsed from the disease, she was in critical condition and rushed to the hospital, and I realized how much she meant to me, and I also had to take a long, hard look at myself, which I think we all have to do sometimes. And I also realized that living without her would have been, our mother had just died. So I knew that when someone dies, you don't think about their faults. You think about all the things that you loved about them. And I realized that's where I was with my sister. So it was a very, moving experience for me, too. I had to look deep within myself.
Now that the book is out.
Pardon?
Go ahead.
Oh, I just was going to say I realized in a way that I was destined to do what I did, because I was named after our grandmother, and our grandmother had died in the 1940s before we were born from the same disease. So I always tell people I think the disease has been a part of me since before I was born.
Very interesting. Now that the book is out then, Suzanne, what are you hoping it will accomplish?
Well, my greatest wish would be that someone that is in research read the book and find the cure for this disease. It's into the fifth generation of our families. But I also hope that people would realize how important their kidneys are, how important it is to take care of our bodies, and how miraculous our bodies are. And then on the flip side, I would love for people to consider being an organ donor, not necessarily a living donor. I never promote that. It's a very personal decision. But my other sister received a kidney transplant from a 12-year-old girl who died suddenly, and I cannot imagine the courage it took for the family to donate.
Family, so, yes, definitely, yes.
So my sister could live. I mean, isn't that the greatest thing you could do for your fellow man? I think it is.
I think that the family, actually, their child lived through the fact that they donated that kidney to your sister, and they can continue to remember her by knowing that somebody lived because of her. I think that's the greatest gift somebody can actually
exactly.
provide to a person.
Yes, and it's
agree.
Been 18 years ago that
wow.
my sister. So it's a miracle that we live in this day and age, and no one likes to think of their death or talk about subjects like death and disease, but I have such a wonderful family that I hope my book, my greatest compliment from a reader is when they say that they laughed and then they cried and then they laughed again when they read the book, because that's how life is.
You know, I was actually reading the excerpt of your book, and as I was introducing you before you came in, and I was telling the reader about how empowering and how they will laugh through the book, and if they read it, they will have tears. So I think it's phenomenal what you're doing and trying to reach out to researcher. And one of the greatest things that I say to myself when I come on the show is that I want to inspire, I want to educate and let people know that your health is very important. So for you coming into the show today and sharing your story and also sharing the importance and the message behind your book is it's very humbling to me, by the way. Let me just say it to you.
Well, Jeanette, it was because of my family. It's not me as much. I always tell people it's my family who gave me the strength, and we all are blessed to have families. And I appreciate your kind words.
So now let me ask you, how did the past and your big Irish Catholic family affect your decision to become a living donor?
Well, our family is so much fun, and yet we have a very grounded faith in, and we've received it from, I never met my grandmother. I told you earlier about her.
Mm-hmm.
She died before I was born, and my mother was a teenager, and they had all gathered around her bed in the hospital when the doctors told her there was nothing more they could do for her with her failing kidneys. And my mother said that when her mother died, she sat up in bed and said, "Here I am, Lord," and died. And my mother was just a teenager, and I can't imagine the impact that made on her. But
mm-hmm.
she also was, and then one by one, they all passed their faith down to us. So it just, even though we were very Catholic, I guess you could say, they were always lots of fun. They always felt like God was had a good sense of humor, and my mother was my mother used to sometimes when she was at her worst, she'd say silly things to me, like, "I had a good talk with the Lord about this pain I'm having," and I just love that she always passed on the feeling to me that you could always turn to God in your worst moments, because she did, and she showed us how to get through them. So I'm blessed to be from a family like that, even though there was a lot of suffering and pain.
So why do you think PKD is such a little-known disease when it affects so many?
Oh, I love that question, because I tell everybody I got so tired of people saying, "PK what?" And no one knows about it. And I don't know if it's because it hits you later in life, the type of PKD we have. There is a different PKD disease that affects infants, but my family has the PKD that affects you as an adult. So I don't know
mm-hmm.
if it's that or if it's because there's no famous movie star or person with the disease. I really don't know why no one knows about it.
You know, actually, they just started introducing tests, like blood tests, at birth. Like when you are pregnant and you have a child, they will now get you to do the PKD test so that they want to know you have the disease somehow. Before, they did not have that. So I can understand why many people did not, you know about the disease. It's when they are introducing that at birth, the mother will ask, "What is that?" And they would tell them what exactly the test was for. So it started introducing the illness, the disease to people's mind little by little. For few people, unless it hits you personally in your family, like you were, not a lot of people are aware of the disease in particular.
And I think that's a wonderful point. We live in an age where genetic testing is just made a great progress during my lifetime. So there are definitely much better testing methods available. But there is the flip side for what we faced when I was growing up with my sisters and a lot of my cousins now. They don't want to be tested because they're terrified of being uninsurable if they have a pre-existing condition, although all of that's changing now. So it might be a much better in the future. What I hoped with the book was that people would never forget how far we've come just in these, mm-hmm. you know, 1940s wasn't that long ago, really, and how far we've come today, and to give hope to people.
1940s, I wasn't even thinking. My mom wasn't even born by that time. So
yes.
It was very sad for me. Yeah, so I understand dearly. I think that science have evolved and we continue to evolve. And I really think that your book will make a difference and get people to do more research and bring the cure for this disease, because we do need cure for a lot of disease, you know. And I think that research will be the only place that we can turn to for social.
I hope so.
So I
hope so, and I hope it gives people hope and encouragement.
Definitely. So, has your life changed since you became a donor?
Oh, completely. I think it's because I did the hardest and most difficult thing, scariest thing that I ever thought I would do, and I faced my biggest fear with my faith, and it completely changed me. It just makes me, I'm happy all the time now. I appreciate the little things of life, and I'm every morning when I open my eyes, I'm so grateful that I have another day.
Few people understand that the concept of being happy, waking up in the morning and looking around you and saying thank you for this day and just being happy all around. I think because of the way society is shaped, we just lost ourselves into the now and forget that we want to celebrate life and celebrate the fact that we're still here.
Well, my sisters and I, both of my sisters and I have this funny joke that if you wake up in the morning and you can pee, it's going to be a great day.
I am going to remember that. Thank you for that. That's great. Wow. Okay. So how has your health changed since you became a donor? Has your health changed?
No, I actually tell everyone that I can do the same things I used to do. I swim. I can do a 5K. I can ride my bicycle and do. I do a Katy ride in Florida for organ donation. And I try to keep active and do all the things that I used to do. I do. I try very hard to promote living donor studies. I wish the National Institute of Health would follow the lives of living donors. And I try to do what I can to find a cure for PKD. But, yes, my health, thank you, is just as good as it was beforehand.
So you mentioned something about following the donor lives and so forth. So for the recipient, it's better than the donor. What would you like to see for the donors?
Well, most of the transplant centers are required by law to follow up within 2 years of the donor. Well, the recipient, my sister, they monthly have checkups, and a lot of the living donors, I think the doctors don't really know quite what to do with all of us, and so I work hard with the National Kidney Foundation to try to make sure there are guidelines for living donors. We are cautioned that our blood pressure might run a little bit higher, but that's mm-hmm. something that everyone should watch, is their, you know their blood pressure, know what it is, and follow it. That's one of the first indicators if your kidneys aren't working properly. So it's basically the things that we all do, but I do know that sometimes the doctors aren't sure. There are not very many of us living donors, although there's more and more every day, and they don't quite know what to do with us or how to follow up on us. And I wish for the future generations that there'll be more research that they can look at to see if they decide to be a living donor, what they can expect.
That's very great. That's very commendable. So how can the medical field then learn about living organ donors?
Well, I know there's never, it always comes down to money, and there's never enough money for studies. But if my greatest hope would be that the National Institute of Health would form a coalition or something to study us, and to so that they could see what we face. And maybe it'll be all an easy study. Maybe we'll all live good lives. I'm hoping so.
Let me just ask you a follow-up question on that for the medical field too. You're talking about doing case study. Like, what do you want them to learn about donors? Like, what specifically are you looking for them to know about those donors?
Well, I guess to make sure that blood pressure does not become a major issue for some of us. I have heard of some people suffering from depression after donating a kidney, and that needs to be addressed. And how medication affects us. I always ask my pharmacist when I have to take medicine, which I very seldom do, but if I do have to, I ask how it affects the kidney. Those kind of things. That's just general follow-up. There's another thing I just thought of was there. I had a femoral hernia after the transplant, and that was said to have been by the surgeon that he thought that was from the removal of the kidney. I don't know whether that is a common thing among living donors, because there's no place to go look and see. So that's what I would like to see.
Very interesting. I'm in agreement with you on that. I definitely think that you should follow up, because you guys have donated a part of you, and the least they can do is to make sure that you guys are okay and follow up and see if there are any issues and how they can help you guys solve those issues. I think that's the least they can do, and I totally in agreement with you on that.
Well, sure, because there was nowhere for me to find any studies out when I was trying to make my decision. There was no data. And, there's that. It just helps sometimes. The more you know, the better you're informed, the easier your decisions always are.
So what advice do you have for living donors?
I always advise them to stay up on their medical care and to, have their routine physical medical care. But to take good, most living donors can't be living donors if they didn't live a healthy life. So most of them know how to live healthy. And that's probably the best advice for all of us, not just living donors, but that's my advice.
I think that we should start learning to be healthy from the start, even before we begin to become donors. Living healthy is very much of a priority in today's society. Actually, we should learn to keep ourselves healthy, to live a healthy lifestyle. Just, you never know.
Absolutely. And you probably will not be able to be a living donor if you don't live a healthy lifestyle.
It's a true statement there. What advice then do you have for each living donor's doctor in that regard?
The same thing, to advise all their living donors to be sure to receive their yearly physical and to watch their numbers mostly. And my advice to any living donor and every is to themselves is to take good care of themselves, but also to give thanks every day for life, for all of us.
Great. How much hope do you have that a cure for PKD will be found?
I have a great deal of hope. They've made amazing progress right now in the world of PKD. You know, there's a lot of skeptical people that point out to me that why are all these diseases not finding a cure? So much money is raised to find a cure, and then they never seem to find a cure. And I just don't like to go down that path of thinking. I like to believe in the goodness of people and our research and science. So I have a lot of hope that there'll be a cure. My father will be turning 89 years old this next week, and he's told everybody he does not want to leave the earth until there's a cure for PKD.
Good for him.
Mm-hmm. He's been a good active in trying to get raise funds for research.
I think if research have found cure in the past for other diseases, finding a cure for PKD is just putting more resources into getting the resources that they need and making sure that they can create what it is that they have to create to come up with the cure that they need so that people can start living longer and if it's not just a cure, a preventative measure, the most strength and restrain preventative measure in making sure that the disease does like a person's life as early as possible. So I definitely think that if we can put more resources into research, any type of research, not just PKD research, we will be able to find a cure for PKD. So I think that your hope is well-founded. And living life without hope actually is not a good life. You should always have hope. If you have something that you believe in, you should keep hope because it's very important. It's very important. And in your case, because of the story and your family, so keeping hope is something that you have to hold on to dearly. And I'm very proud and to see that you are doing just that and that you have your father and the rest of your family working together in making sure that there will be a cure for PKD one someday.
I completely agree with you. Living without hope is not living. If you don't have hope, it's life is too dark without, you have to have hope. I agree.
Why do you think then there should be studies done on living donors?
Just so that someday my niece or my nieces will be able to look up and see what their Aunt Susie had to face so that the next generation will say, oh, look, she lived just fine afterward. That's what I hope. So there will be people that come after us that will learn from us, just like I wrote about all the people in my book who I learned from, all my aunts and uncles who died from PKD and my grandmother. Just so we keep, we don't lose what we've learned now and we pass it on to the next generation.
So basically, it's a message of empowering communities and inspiring people to know that living and donating an organ is not something that you cannot handle. You can be able to do it and still live a normal life like if any other person who hasn't donated anything. That's basically what you are looking forward to.
Exactly.
Okay. So now, who do you think that will fund the studies? All these studies that you are talking about, who do you think will be able to fund those studies?
Well, I know the University of Minnesota did do a study, and it was along with I believe, two other transplant centers. And that's the only study that I know of right now that has been done. I might just not be informed on all the studies because I'm not in the medical field. But I suppose the transplant centers are probably the first, and probably some of the transplant centers do their own studies within themselves. So that would be probably the most sensible first step. And the University of Minnesota did try to get one going, and they did do one. So I think the University of Birmingham and the Mayo Clinic was in that study also. So the transplant centers are probably the first point of order for them for the study, and then maybe the National Institute of Health is the one that I keep saying would be wonderful if they could do a study on. I know the National Institute of Health is the largest contributor to research for PKD.
I'll say keep on pushing. Don't even stop. Determination is key.
Yes.
Do you think that living donation will continue?
Well, first and foremost, I would prefer that there be a cure for polycystic kidney disease. I'm sure that there will always be people who need kidney transplants for various other reasons not associated with PKD. But for me, my greatest prayer is that PKD would be, a cure would be found first, and that would be the best thing in the world for living donors. They wouldn't need as many. And I used to know the statistic. Of the 90,000 you mentioned that are waiting for a kidney, I believe it's about one-third of them have PKD, but I'm not positive on that.
Wow. I'm going to do more research on that, and I probably will do a follow-up.
You can talk to my sister. She knows better.
Great. What do you think that is important for future generations to know about today living donation?
Oh, I think my most humbling moment was when a woman came up to me and told me that she takes my book with her when she goes to her dialysis treatments. And I felt that was, I still get choked up thinking about it, because in my book I write about how my aunt needed dialysis in the 1960s, and there were not enough dialysis machines available. And she was only 45 years old, and she decided that she would not put her name down on the waiting list for a dialysis machine. And so that's why I hope that, just like with living donation, I hope all of the future generations to come will learn from our stories about what we've gone through and how much our stories will help them to appreciate what they have in their lifetime, just like I hope my stories help someone appreciate what we have today.
You know, you mentioned something about unity earlier on, and I just want to ask you something. Why do you think organ donation is the great unifier of all?
Oh, I love that question, because my uncle, who was one of the very earliest recipients of a kidney transplant back in the early 70s, he said, there's a quote in my book where he said, "I don't care if the recipient was, or the donor whose kidney he received, it was someone who had died." He said, "I don't care if they are Republican or Democrat, black or white, purple or yellow, or if they like to sing or don't like to sing." When you need an organ transplant, we're all the same, and it doesn't matter who the organ comes to from. I mean, obviously, for medically, it has to match your blood type, or that's been changed. But really and truly, when my sister received her kidney transplant from that 12-year-old girl, I just think we didn't care who donated, just so that my sister lived. So I think it's the one thing that maybe could bring all people together, because we're all really the same, whether you're Irish or Catholic or Baptist and, I don't know, Chinese, or it doesn't matter. We're all the same. really.
It's giving life that matters. It's maintaining a life that matters. Does more.
Yes.
It's not about the person who's donating. It's not about the color. It's about the life that you're about to save. That's all matters.
And when it comes right down to it, it's all about life.
It's all about life.
Yes.
So what are some of the reasons then that people do not become organ donors? Because you have people that refuse to be organ donors.
The most common reason that I hear, and I have volunteered at many organ donation health fairs, and I worked with this when I lived in Minnesota with the DMV in the state of Minnesota, where you sign up to be an organ donor when you're receiving your driver's license. The most common reason people don't want to become an organ donor is they're afraid the doctor won't do everything to save their life because someone else needs an organ, when in fact the doctor has taken an oath to do everything possible to save your life, and they have no connection. Your team of doctors working to save your life has no connection or involvement with the doctors who are involved in a transplant or a patient who needs a transplant. All doctors take an oath to do everything and anything to save your life. And if that's the main reason. A lot of people think their religion doesn't approve of organ donations, and almost all the major religions, I think all of them, I have a list somewhere of them all, but all approve of organ donation. But my funniest reason for someone who did not sign up to be an organ donor, and when she told me why she did not want to be an organ donor, she said it was because she was not ever going to die.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So that, and that was what I said to her. I said, well, let me know how that turns out.
You know, I don't even know what to answer to that. You actually get an answer, because I probably would have just looked at like, okay, I not knowing what to say in return. So, wow. Okay, that's...
Well, I had thought I heard every reason in the book, but that was the first time I had heard that one.
Well, I know of one reason that somebody gave me one time. One of the reasons that I heard of somebody telling me why they didn't want to provide their organs was because of the fact that they thought by providing the name to the organ, to the system, to say that, yeah, if they're no longer alive, they can donate organs and so forth, they were worried that somebody would actually come and kill them just for the organs. So that was one that I heard, and I was like, pretty interesting. I didn't know what to say about that either, but that's basically what I heard.
Yeah, and I think that's because of some of the ridiculous television shows that are on television about organ donation. There was one famous show that was where they were running down from one floor or from one hospital around in the city to the other with an organ, and it's not like that at all. And I guess because of the way my family is, and sometimes you just have to trust in the system and the goodness of people, and I do in regards to organ donation.
I think that we should never give up on people, and you should always trust on their goodness. Though we do have people who aren't good, but we also have good people. We still have good people around us. So I think you're right. We should always believe in the goodness in people versus always thinking the worst of them. So,
well, I remember my mother did end up receiving a kidney transplant, and her transplant came from a 42-year-old man who died, and his wife was a nurse. And my mother used to tell us that the first person she wanted to meet when she got to heaven was the man who gave her his kidney, because she wanted to give him her deepest gratitude, because my mother was able to see her grandchildren grow up and graduate from college. And she said, without that man's incredible gift to me, I would never have been able to see them grow up. And she said, my grandchildren will remember me now because of that man. So I think my mother was such a a woman who is full of so much gratitude and joy that I, that's how I want
to. To you. That's
yes.
What you want to be. What do you believe is the greatest gift you can give a person?
Life.
I think that you actually answered that question, your mom.
I think faith. My mother. The greatest gift my mother gave me was her faith. But I would say life and faith. Those are two of the greatest gifts you can give someone.
Wonderful. Thank you, Suzanne, for joining me today. And I hope your mission reach out to many and help raise more awareness about this issue. Does find a cure for PKD. We are coming at the end of our show today here live at BBS Radio. Don't worry. We'll be back Saturday, March 16, 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time and 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Before I exit, I will leave you with two inspirational quotes and hope that you enjoy the time spent listening to us today. The measure of life is not its duration, but its donation. Peter Marshall. I admire anyone who rids himself of an addiction. Jean Henney. Thank you, Shauna Paul and Suzanne Ruff, too, for joining me today. And I hope today's talk show made a difference in anyone who are listening to us today. And for my listeners, thank you for tuning in. Until next time, have a blissful Saturday. Ciao now.